The Laura Murphy Show, episode 37.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another scintillating episode of The Laura Murphy Show. As I promised you previously, we are now back to having both Carlos Lara and Bob Murphy on the podcast. Carlos, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. And hey, it's good to have you back in Nashville again.
That's right, folks. It's an odd situation, but I am recording mere meters from Carlos. But we were afraid if we tried to share the same mic that it would screw things up. And so I went in the other room and closed the door. So we're still doing it the way we always do remotely, even though we are literally meters apart. So, Carlos, why don't you tell the curious listeners, why is it that I'm in Nashville temporarily?
Well, sure. I'd be glad to do that. Well, of course, you had one speaking engagement, which took place last night. I'll let you talk about that if you want. But then this morning, very early this morning, actually, we did another little brief seminar for, I don't know, about 20 or so business owners that attended a breakfast at 7:15 this morning. And it was kind of neat, I thought. We described the IBC tax strategy, which is a strategy that I've been writing about in the LMR this last couple of months, part one and two. And from the reception we got, Bob, what do you think? They seem to receive it quite well.
Well, yeah, it's a nice contrast that there's pros and cons of doing it in front of a big crowd versus a more intimate setting with the business owners. So, yeah, we just got up there and we're literally just a few feet from the people telling the information. So it did have a different feel to it. I think, yeah, a lot of those people were really intrigued and wanted to learn more.
Yeah. And of course, it was sponsored by one of our authorized IBC practitioners. You know, this is a person. It's a female practitioner who is one of our graduates from the course that we created for financial professionals. And whenever they ask us to speak, we make every effort to do that. And so that's what that was. And you're right. It was a very small meeting room, but it was very intimate. And, you know, the food was fantastic. And like I said, it was early in the morning. But, business owners like to get going very early in the morning. And we were done by 9 o'clock, I think. And so as far as I could tell, the strategy really made people think. And so folks, you should check this out in the LMR if you have an opportunity. It's a fantastic strategy using your tax dollars to do some very creative things with it before you pay it out to the IRS. So check it out in the LMR.
That's right. So remember, everyone, if you're a new listener, you want to go to laramurphy.com. That's LARA-Murphy.com and click on the tab giving you sample issues of the Laura Murphy Report. And if you're a subscriber, you can read the two-part series that Carlos has devoted in recent issues to this IBC tax strategy. So speaking of taxes, and we'll bring it back to the topic at hand here. So this is this particular episode now, 37, is part 3 of 3. And so we've been doing this GOP tax reform and international trade bit. The previous two installments, remember, folks, I laid out the basic theory of tax reform and explained some of the nuances of the GOP tax reform plan, which involved this controversial thing of a border adjustment tax. So why don't I just review that a little bit. If you want more information on this, what I'm going to be talking about right now, again, I would point you to our website, laramurphy.com, and in particular, the most recent blog post there that you can see it right from the front page called A Major Problem with the Pro-Border Adjustment Tax Arguments. Okay, so let me, for you right now, summarize what my issue was there. So the big picture here is the Republicans back, this was last summer, they came out with a major overhaul of corporate taxes. And just so you know, the U.S. corporate income tax rate currently at 35% is the highest among OECD countries, and in fact is something like the second or third highest in the world, period. All right, so obviously other people in Europe or whatever, they have a higher tax burden overall. But when we're talking just about taxes on corporations, the U.S. is actually literally one of the worst on earth in that respect. So what the let me also just mention another element in all this, and this ties into a lot of the rhetoric you saw from the Trump campaign, some of his key advisors during the campaign, was that they were trying to say, look, it's not so much that we're against trade per se. We like fair trade. It's just that the deck is stacked against U.S. companies under the current system. And there is an element of truth in what they're saying that, for example, the example I use, let's say there's a German firm, okay, in Germany, and they operate under a VAT, a value-added tax. And so the way that thing works is the German government's paying, the companies that are involved in that product are paying taxes to the German government all along in the supply chain. Then, though, if that company exports the product to the United States, they get a rebate from the German government on the VAT that has been paid for that particular unit. Okay, so, and then on the U.S. side, the U.S. federal government right now tends to raise revenues for corporate activities based on an income tax, and it doesn't have jurisdiction over a German firm, right? So it doesn't charge income tax on the German firm that tries to ship products to the United States. So effectively, that product that the German firm exports into the U.S. isn't getting taxed by either government. On the flip side, the U.S. company, the competitor of that firm, if it wants to sell a product here in the United States, they got to still pay income tax. If then they want to ship it to Germany, they're still paying the income tax. It's not that the IRS gives you a rebate under current law for income taxes you as a corporation paid on something that was made in the U.S. but then exported. And then when it goes over to Germany, it gets hit with the VAT, right? Because the way the VAT works is any imports coming in get slapped with the full percentage of the VAT to put it on an even footing with domestic goods. So the idea is, just to review, the way the current system works is a U.S. firm selling in the U.S. pays U.S. federal income tax. If the U.S. firm wants to export, let's say, to Germany, it still pays U.S. federal income tax and then pays the VAT. In contrast, its German competitor, if they ship their goods over to the United States, they get a rebate on the VAT, so they don't pay the VAT and they don't pay U.S. income tax. So there seems to be a clear-cut advantage, and then it's really perverse if you think about outsourcing. Suppose there's a U.S. company that's making products in the United States to sell to American consumers. Well, under this regime, you could see how it might make sense. You'd save on a bunch on taxes to just relocate your factory, let's say, to Germany or, to some other place with cheaper labor that also has a VAT structure, so that you make the thing over there and then ship it back to the United States. All you've done is, by rearranging it, is change your tax liability. Okay, so those are the kinds of things that Trump and his advisors were bringing up to try to explain why, this system seems to be rigged. And the GOP tax reform proposal sought to address this. So one thing they were going to do is they were going to lower that corporate income tax rate from 35% down to 20%. But then they were going to do what was called this border adjustment tax, BAT. And this is the thing now that was really controversial and had a lot of people concerned, is they were going to say, okay, effectively what they were going to do is mimic the way the VAT operates, in that they would apply the domestic tax to any imports when they crossed the border and came into the U.S. And for any U.S. firms that exported products, they wouldn't be subject to that tax, which, again, this is standard operating procedure for how VATs are applied. And now the mechanics of it for the inside baseball, for the purists out there, strictly speaking, the way they were going to do that is they were still levying the U.S. corporate income tax on U.S. firms. They weren't explicitly going to put up a tariff barrier. Instead, what they were going to do is say for U.S. companies that are paying this now lower, you know, 20% corporate income tax rate, if you import goods, well, you don't get to deduct that as a business expense. Okay, so right now, you know, Walmart pays a bunch of money to get television sets from China. And when Walmart, you know, its accountants will go ahead and run the numbers and figure out what's their net income at the end of the year to report that to the IRS. The point is, if you pay, you know, you have business expenses for imports, you don't get to deduct that as a business expense. And on the flip side, revenues that they get from exports, they don't have to report it as gross income. So effectively what that means is it's like you're paying, you know, now that corporate income tax rate of 20% is being slapped onto the cost of imports coming into the United States, because now you're not getting that tax deduction that you normally would have. And on the flip side, it's like there's a tax exemption now for any exports because that income's not being reported. And so you're not getting hit with a 20% corporate income tax rate on that. So it's like you're getting to export them tax-free. Okay, so again, it's kind of a convoluted process to sort of mimic the way a VAT operates. So it's not a VAT. It's still a corporate income tax, but they're making these adjustments, these border adjustments, to try to make it more closely resemble the way the VAT operates. So that's the big picture. Now, the concern was a lot of free traders were saying, geez, you know, if you're effectively slapping a new 20% tax on imports, isn't that going to make prices rise to U.S. consumers? You know, isn't that protectionism? Didn't Bastiat and other, you know, Adam Smith, didn't they teach us that free trade is good? And so isn't this a bad move? And so you had a lot of heavy hitter economists, including Paul Krugman and Martin Feldstein, who are experts on international trade. Krugman literally won the Nobel Prize for his work on international trade, saying, look, there's reasons you might want to oppose this Republican plan, but to worry about imports now all of a sudden being 20% more expensive, that's silly. And they said, because what would happen is the dollar would appreciate in this new regime, and it would perfectly offset the direct effects of this new tax on imports and exemption on exports. And so the claim is that, oh, if the dollar were to appreciate 25%, if you run the numbers, you know, that perfectly offsets. So yes, Americans have to pay 20% surtax on top of the imports, but if the dollar is now that much stronger, the two things exactly counterbalance. And so on net, out of pocket, U.S. consumers don't have to pay more for those TVs from China. And on the other side, yes, exporters have an advantage. They're, if you want to think of it this way, being implicitly subsidized to export. And so they're willing to charge lower prices because they're not being taxed. But on the other hand, it's harder for foreigners to buy our stuff now because the dollar is stronger. So U.S. goods look artificially more expensive to foreigners because of the strengthening dollar. So that's the issue. That's the claim, I should say. And you might wonder, okay, well, gee, if it's a big wash, what's the point in doing all that? And here's where Martin Feldstein comes in and says, oh, because think of it, imports are higher than exports right now in the United States. And so if the U.S. government is getting basically to tax, you know, a new 20% tax on imports and effectively has to give a 20% subsidy to exports, well, since there are more imports than exports, that means on net, the Treasury is making money. And he runs the numbers and says, in fact, the government will bring in $120 billion a year because of this thing, and it won't hurt U.S. consumers and it won't hurt U.S. producers. Isn't that neat? So I just want to say here, now that I've summarized the thing, I think that's wrong. If you want to see an argument as to why it's wrong, step by step, I refer you to the blog post at lauramurphy.com where I walk through this. But for our purposes here in this podcast, let me just appeal to your common sense and say, how can that possibly be right? How can Feldstein be right to say U.S. consumers and producers, it's going to be a wash, and trade flows aren't going to be affected, and the federal government is going to get $120 billion a year to play with. That can't be right. That's a free lunch. And so I think specifically what would happen where Feldstein's argument goes wrong is I think the dollar might appreciate, but not enough to fully offset it. And so I do think if this plan were to go through as proposed, that you would see, you know, so yes, the U.S. government would make money, but it'd be because it levied a new tax. And just like any other tax has implications, same thing here, it would drive a wedge between foreign producers and U.S. consumers and vice versa. And it would put up an artificial barrier to trade and leading to all the negative consequences from that. So in particular, Americans would see prices go up of everything that is imported. So maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a bad thing, depending on your value system and what you think of the fiscal situation is. But I'm saying I think policymakers should not believe guys like Feldstein when he's, you know, assuring them, oh, don't worry, you go ahead and do this, and the dollar will just perfectly appreciate to offset all this stuff, and it'll be painless, and you have all this extra money to play with. So I think that's very dangerous. So, Carlos, I've monopolized the conversation here. Why don't you take some time, and you know, this is actually some of the stuff you went over in the breakfast meeting today with the business owners, but this general idea of tax reform and what looks good on paper and how it actually turns out in practice, you've got some bitter personal experience with this.
Yeah, but first of all, let me say that it's a good thing you're a PhD economist and you begin to see exactly what it is that you do. Keeping all that stuff straight, that's something else. I mean, I was trying to even keep up with what you were saying, and it's difficult. It's difficult to follow all that. So,
Imagine the people who are driving and trying to listen to this. They're probably going off the road.
But it's kind of neat, actually, that you can keep all of that together and make sense out of it and help the rest of us that have difficulty following it to explain it the way you do. It makes a lot of sense, even if we have to take it in small doses, listen to the podcast several times over, because this is the kind of stuff that we're dealing with right now. Well, as far as the question you're asking me, Bob, you know, I only have one way of relating to what I, you know, to what I think about goes on when I hear the word that they're going to look into tax reform again. You know, it kind of bothers me. It frightens me a little bit because there's all kinds of unintended things that happen when government comes in and starts tamping around with the tax code. And I remember very distinctly when the 1986 tax reform came into play and why it came into play. And, you know, I can talk a little bit about a little bit of history maybe. But again, it's only dealing with what was happening here with us here in this country, not necessarily what's going on in other countries, except to say that, you know, when Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971, I mean, it really did create massive inflation. All of a sudden, you know, central banks, you know, were much, much freer, you know, to print money at will. And so central banks have grown very powerful, you know, since then especially. And governments around the world, as well as here, have also grown immensely powerful because they mandate, you know, money policy, monetary policy. And so the combination of those two institutions, the central bank and governments, I mean, they basically have the money and banking completely locked up. And it really puts pressure on all of us, especially when we're having to deal with inflation and on top of that, high tax rates. In the 70s, I don't know if people remember this or not, but the highest income tax rate was 70%. And capital gains tax was 30%. So it was a pretty high tax rate at the highest income levels. I do remember that in, you know, when I was in my early 30s, around 1978, 1979, we started seeing the interest rate, prime rate interest rate, start to climb, you know, jumping up to 8%, 9%, 10%, 11%, 12%. You know, just in that 1 year period, we saw all those different changes in the interest rate. And again, and then on top of that, we have, you know, this high tax on income. And then in 1980, of all things, that interest rate, you know, jumps up to 21.5% prime rate. Of course, that's prime rate. You know, if you're a credit-worthy borrower, if you're not, you're going to pay a couple of points more, so 23, 24%. And, you know, that's an incredibly high interest rate. But this is the kind of things that people were dealing with in 1980, in addition to this, you know, this high income tax that we had. And so sure enough, during those 70s and the 80s, you know, some creative financial advisors trying to deal with these two monsters, high tax, high income tax, high capital gains tax, and this inflation, they came up with these tax shelters, you know, especially for the wealthy. They were designed for the wealthy. And these tax shelters, for those that remember, were tied directly to real estate. And billions of dollars were being put into these things. And, of course, that bothered Congress. You know, anytime, again, Congress is always operating in a deficit situation. So when they don't see taxes coming their way, you know, they frown on it. And so they didn't like those tax shelters at all. They saw them as loopholes for the wealthy. And the industry for these tax shelters was just mushrooming. But after a while, it started filtering down to the little guy. I mean,
if I could just stop you there, Carlos, because I mean, it is, we hear that and it sounds kind of incredible for people my age, even that I was alive when that happened, but I certainly wasn't earning a serious income or anything. I was a little kid, but that's kind of incredible to think that there could be the top tax rate being that high. So clearly it's not that everyone just said, oh, okay. And they went out and earned their income and just paid 70 out of every $100 to the government, you know, above a certain threshold. They were trying to come up with ways to shield their money and to not have to pay that confiscatory rate.
Exactly. And of course, that's what we all do. You know, I don't know that it's so much that we're against paying taxes necessarily. It's just, you know, when taxes aren't they levy the taxes on certain groups or something like that. You know, it gets to be kind of a real problem, but nobody likes to pay taxes. And then this inflation monster, too, is just as bad. So you've got that going on, but these tax shelters, they absolutely took off and everybody was getting into them. And like I said, even the little guy could get into one of these tax shelters for as little as $5,000. And there was a way to obviously, you know, deduct, get tax deductions. And they started getting out of control. I mean, they started out with real estate, and then the next thing you knew, they were doing them on racehorses, greyhound dogs. And, you know, of course they did them with oil and gas too, but anyway, they were just, that was the thing. Now, Ronald Reagan came in 1981, and of course, his whole thing was, listen, what we need to do is lower the tax. If we would just lower the tax, people wouldn't, you know, do these loopholes, these tax loopholes. You know, that's what would stop that kind of thing. So obviously he kept pushing that along. And so in 1986, you know, we saw the complete, you know, overhaul of the entire taxing system. And sure enough, the highest tax rate did come down. It came down to 28%, Bob, and the capital gains tax came down to 20%. So it really did reduce the taxes. on folks, on people.
Yeah, just to clarify, it was like a stepwise thing that there were some big rate reductions up front in the early 80s. And then, yeah, they lowered even more in 86. And also to clarify for listeners, what Carlos is talking about here, the logic of that we walked through in the previous episode, right? The idea of the supply side claim that, hey, what you want to do is have the tax apply to as broad a base as possible so you keep that rate as low as possible for a given amount of revenue. And that's the theory, and that's what Carlos was getting at. That's what they thought they were doing, and they did do it. But to get the broadest base, what that means is you don't want to have deductions or special, what's called loopholes. So, okay, I'll let you resume the story.
Yeah, and all I'm saying is that even though Reagan brought the tax rates down that way, they didn't stay down for long, as you know, because we got higher tax rates right now. But, he did bring them down. Now, even though the tax rates came down during this Tax Reform Act, Congress still killed these tax shelters. I mean, basically outlawed them. And so on the one end, you get this great thing because now you got low taxes. But I mean, it's sent a wave of bankruptcies throughout these nations because it completely collapsed the real estate market, both, the commercial real estate and then the residential. It was disastrous. And so it's interesting. They start fooling around with things like that, and they do one thing, but they create another bigger mess. And so, this was a bad period when this happened. The real estate market had not been that bad since the Depression. It was that bad. And so you had major bankruptcies, throughout the country and some very, very famous people you would read about in the headlines, the newspaper, that so-and-so had to file for bankruptcy because they were deep into these tax shelters.
And so we don't have to get bogged down the weeds too much, but just to make sure our average listener gets the big picture. So the idea was there were all kinds of provisions in the tax code in 1985, let's say, where if you invested in certain types of qualifying real estate, for example, it gave you a lot of tax advantages. So people were getting into this stuff largely because it would help reduce your tax bill. And then when Congress went around and revamped it and took, tried to make the tax code leaner and simpler and so on, an offshoot of that was now there was no reason, you wouldn't have bought into all these different real estate properties and projects if it weren't for the convoluted tax rules. And so once they took that away, there was no reason to hold that property. And that kind of just, made people want to start selling and kind of collapse the market.
Well, yeah. If they make it illegal to do these things, one of the steps in that whole process of these tax shelters would be that after they depreciated the property out, that they would sell the property. And that's where they would make additional money. The investors in this thing, but they wound up collapsing the economy. So in effect, it just kind of like blew a hole in the economy where, shopping centers were going under, high rises, you couldn't sell them. Nothing was moving. So it just kind of destroyed that whole industry. Not only that, but it just made it, you couldn't do it anymore. And so, like I said, the 1986 tax reform did have this one thing come in where they did lower the taxes, but created another huge problem on the economy. And of course, 1 year later, this was 1986. The following year, the economy's already in bad shape from the real estate situation. Well, then that's when we had the worst stock market crash in history up to that point. So you see, it was like a domino effect, one bad thing leading to another bad thing. And that was Black Monday when that happened. So I guess my point is that I hear them talking about tax reform again. I get a little frightened. What kind of mess are they going to create now in trying to fix things?
Yeah, that's a good point. And on that, one thing that I think I saw, I think Scott Sumner was the first person to raise this issue that I saw. So this was before I had my concerns about, well, gee, I'm not even sure the dollar would appreciate enough. And I was walking through Feldstein's logic to try to see, you know, was there a flaw there? But even on its own terms, if you say, oh, no, in a little simple model here in the textbook, if we levy a big tax on imports and give rebates to exports and and the dollar will appreciate and it'll perfect, no problem, won't hurt. Even if that were true, which again, I'm thinking there's flaws in that, but the dollar appreciating 25%, well, that's going to mess up a lot of people around the world. Those people who have debts, you know, quote, denominated in dollars. And, you know, if they live in other countries and they earn income in their own currency, and then all of a sudden the dollar appreciates 25% because of this radical policy move, you know, those people, all of a sudden that makes the value of their debt go up 25%. So, I mean, that could certainly cause hardship. And again, that's in the best case scenario where everything is a wash in terms of consumers and producers and the prices they get after tax. So you're right, Carlos, that these, you know, people talk about this stuff, and I think Keynesians are much more guilty of this than Austrians, I'd like to think, where if the economy is two lines that intersect on a page, and that's the way you're thinking about the macro economy, and oh, right now, if unemployment's high, it's because aggregate demand's not big enough. Let's just go ahead and lower interest rates. And they don't realize this came up at that meeting I was at last night that you alluded to in the beginning of the episode, Carlos. I was speaking at a Nashville Christian discussion group where they also bring in speakers that speak on more secular topics. And that came up, the issue of these underfunded pensions, and people were talking about that and what do you do? And I just pointed out that, well, yeah, these are very low interest rates that we've had since 2009. That's one of the reasons that certain companies are struggling, that they were, you know, when interest rates were in normal levels, they had been setting aside enough money for their employees' future retirement payments, pension plans and whatnot. But then all of a sudden, if rates collapse, well, now that amount of money you've been putting aside isn't enough. You got to go search for higher yield and take on riskier investments and so on. So a lot of this stuff, but you know, that's not in a simple model that just says, oh, well, if there's not enough spending, just lower interest rates. There you go. Problem solved. They don't have pension funds in those models. They don't have life insurance companies and so on, which, you know, things that are very interest rate sensitive. So believe it or not, folks, the real world is a lot more complicated than economists and certainly policymakers in D.C. keep in mind when they're making these decisions. And we're just in this episode here raising some of the issues. And Carlos, I know, had a personal experience with that. We're getting close to our time here, Carlos, but can you, since you set the table so perfectly, you want to just go ahead and tell what happened, you know, after this, you know, the Tax Reform Act and whatever, and then, you know, what were the wealthy people supposed to do? Because I just, as far as the connection to IBC, this is such a great element of the story.
Well, yeah, in connection to IBC, it is a great connection to that, because really, when you think about it, you know, individuals in the world, when they get involved in any kind of investment or a financial product of some sort, you know, this is really what they're fighting against is how do I keep from paying so much taxes? How do I keep from this inflation, you know, continue to erode the purchasing power of my money? And then market volatility, you know, how can I stop that from, you know, playing ping pong with my money, you know? So investors, people investing in things, and this is the battle that they have. And unfortunately, the way things are today, they've turned us all into a nation of speculators. You know, we don't even know whether it's even worth it to save money anymore, you know, so we're constantly having to invest in things. And so we're speculating. Well, all that means is that there's risk involved when you start speculating. You don't know if it's going to hold together or not. But during this particular period, of course, it was interesting because even though they shut down these tax shelters, the wealthy was still, you know, still needing to know from their tax attorneys, okay, so now where do we put our money? Where do we go now? I mean, the stock market's crashed, real estate is shot. So, hey guys, where do we put our money now? And the interesting thing, Bob, was that these tax attorneys dealing with these wealthy individuals told them to take one check, write one big fat check for all the money they had, and to drop it into a single premium whole life insurance policy. You know, just so that's a one payment policy.
And how could that be, though, Carlos? We all know the worst thing to do with your money is to put it in one of these things. And you're saying the experts told their wealthy clients, we want you to just dump a bunch of money in these things?
Yeah, I mean, it's true, though. It's true because billions of dollars went, you know, the same kind of billions that were going into the tax shelters, the billions now went into these single premium whole life insurance policies. And, of course, Congress, again, you know, raise their eyebrows. You know, what the heck is going on here? We just created the 86 Act, and now here it is, 1987, and now they're going here. And, well, the reason they told them, Bob, is because, if you ask anybody to write down on a piece of paper what for them would make up the ideal or the perfect investment, and they start writing things down, it's the same list because we all want the same things. And when we're getting down to the bottom of the list, which usually has about 12, 13, 14 items on it, you start to think there is no such animal. I mean, this is be too good to be true kind of thing. You know, but when I tell people that what they've designed is actually dividend paying whole life, you know, they can't believe it. And when I ask him, how come you can't believe it? He said, well, it's because I've always heard it's the worst place to put your money. But it has all those features. So this is really what these tax attorneys came up with. They say because of all those reasons. But obviously, there were three big reasons why. One of them is because when they were in they're inside one of these policies, they have complete control and access to their money. You know, anytime they needed, no questions asked. And of course, they take this money out using policy loans, which is a contractual right of each one of these insurance contracts. Also, the terms for the repayment of these loans are not set by the life insurance company. They're set by the policy owner. So the terms are extremely flexible, and you don't see that anywhere, wherever you're borrowing money, where you know, you get to set your own terms. A third reason why these tax attorneys said you need to go here is because you truly do have uninterrupted compounding, which takes place inside of these contracts. And so you don't have any kind of market volatility going on. And the growth is you know, chugging along tax free, so it's paying interest, it's paying dividends, and it's being building equity in these policies all on a tax free basis. So it has all of the features that you would want in what you know you and I, Bob, refer to as a form of private banking. It's a form of being able to practice a form of privatized banking with one of these things. And so this is the reason that they were instructed to go there.
Well, yeah, it really is amazing. You know, it's sort of hard for us to step outside of it now and remember how we used to think in terms of, does this make any sense? Because it is, again, just to summarize, folks, that, you know, these wealthy investors were being advised by their high-powered, high-priced tax attorneys that, yep, you want to go ahead and write a big check and get single premium whole life insurance. And so it, you know, that should at least make you stop and pause when you hear like, oh yeah, everybody knows that's a crazy place to put your money. Well, then you'd wonder why were wealthy people being advised to do it back then. So we should say we're brushing up here against the clock, so we should probably wrap things up. But I just want to make some housekeeping announcements here because I get feedback from people and realize we take it for granted that everybody has listened to all the episodes and so on, and that may not be true. So if you're intrigued, but about this IBC, that stands for Infinite Banking Concept. I want to point you to episodes 17 and 18 of this podcast. So again, you go to laramurphy.com. There's a hyphen in between Lara and Murphy there. And just go in the archives for the podcast, go back to episodes 17 and 18. And that's where Carlos and I started from scratch. And so it's a how-to guide for starting IBC. And so we explain this all from step one in case we're losing you a little bit here and there and you're not sure exactly what the context is for all of this. But really, we encourage you to go check that out. And then the next step you're going to do and make sure you're aware of this is Carlos and I and Nelson Nash and David Stearns have designed a practitioner program for financial professionals to go through and get trained in how do you tailor these particular policies the IBC way. And you want to find someone who's been through that program. And where are those people located? Well, you go to infinitebanking.org/finder. And then that's the way you go and see the graduates of our program who are out there. Because we're here sort of evangelizing to the masses, if you will. But for you to know how to apply this to your own personal situation, whether you're just a household or a business owner, you're going to need to talk to somebody and tell them a little bit about, you know, your situation, and they can give you recommendations. So that's why you want to go to the finder when you're serious about taking the next step in this. But again, we want you to educate yourself first so you understand what this is. And you go to episodes 17 and 18 are a great place to start for that. Any final words of wisdom for our loyal listeners, Carlos?
Well, no, just be sure to check out the free samples of the LMR. That also will help you. There's plenty of articles there dealing with subject matter that we're talking about. And then maybe perhaps even become a subscriber and keep up with more current things.
Great. So what I'll do, folks, to make it even easier for you is if you just get your way to episode 37, which is what you're listening to right now, we'll put links in too to the episode 17, 18, and the practitioner finder to make it quite simple to find that stuff. So again, go ahead and look at episode 17, 18. Ultimately, you want to get to the practitioner finder. And as Carlos says, we encourage you, there's a whole bunch of free sample articles from the Lara Murphy Report at our website. You go to lara-murphy.com, and Lara is L-A-R-A, laramurphy.com, and just look at the top toolbar there, and you'll see all kinds of tabs for the podcast, the Lara Murphy Report, and so on. So there's lots of information there. We encourage you to check it out. All right, thanks, everyone. We're out of time, and we will catch you for the next episode. Stay tuned for more.
You've just finished another episode of The Lara Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Lara Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of laramurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.